Mark 16, 1 through 8. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early, on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The Gospel of our Lord.
I know your eyes are drawn to the cross here, but there are other flowers. There are other flowers around me. And one of the traditions we've had as a church is each Easter to take Easter lilies to our shut-in members. And so on each one of these lilies, there's a name. It's one of our shut-in members and her address or his address there on that plant. And we would encourage you today to think how you can share this Easter love with our shut-ins. And so after our service, please feel free to come forward and take one of these and take it today or in the next day or so to one of our shut-ins. Hell took a body and discovered God. It took earth and discovered heaven. It took what it could see and discovered what it could not see. Those are powerful words, aren't they? They're from a sermon that's over 1,600 years old, still just as powerful and true. They were delivered by a man, written by a man named John Chrysostom. John was such a good preacher that they gave him the nickname Chrysostom, and Chrysostom means golden mouth. That's a good nickname for a preacher, isn't it? Golden mouth. People flocked to hear him preach. Once he'd been preaching one of his very eloquent sermons and going on and on, and by the way, they were a lot longer than mine, okay? People had interrupted him a number of times with clapping and kind of cheering and whistles and that kind of thing. And so by the end of the sermon, he started to get a little steamed by all the clapping. He sat down for a second. They gave him a nice little round of applause. He got right back up and started preaching another sermon to them about how God is the only one to glorify. Don't put any man over another man. And he preached another 30-minute sermon for them, for applauding for him. When he finished, he went and sat down, and they stood up and gave him a standing ovation. I mean, you know what? If you're that good, I guess there's just nothing else you can do, right? I've noticed that I don't have to tell you to stand. Or I do have to tell you to stand at the end, you know, of the sermons. I have noticed that. So, but I'm not complaining because there are so many more people who deserve applause in the church than the preacher. Let me tell you. One of those groups I learned very early on as church secretaries or ministry assistants, or there's no name that we can give them that would do them justice. We still have some former church secretaries who are still members of this church, and that's no little thing, okay? Sue Finley, here you are, Sue. Sharon Kemp, Lori O'Donohoe, all worked in our church office and has done fabulous work for this church. Now, Donna Boyd is that first person that often people will talk to on the telephone or meet when they come in our doors. She's the perfect person for it. She is the face and the hands and the voice of the Northlake Church for many people, and she's done a great job in that. And then there's Debbie Caldwell. And Debbie, this month, has worked for the Northlake Church for 30 years. Now, I think that's applause worthy, you see? Yeah. And you see, people know when to applaud, don't they? You don't even have to tell them when to applaud. Most of that time, this poor woman has worked with me. And as it's been said, I have a tendency to have a ready, aim, 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 fire personality. Debbie, on the other hand, has a ready, fire, fire, fire personality. We just pass her more ammunition every once in a while, and she's happy. And we thank God for her every day. Thank you, Debbie, for the great ministry that you've done in this church. There are many women who've served this church in other roles as teachers, care group leaders, counselors, friends, role models, grandmothers in the faith. It goes on and on. Let's face it, they've done it with a fraction of the recognition that men usually get. And for too long, you know, that really wasn't strange enough to us, was it? I guess that's why we sometimes miss the surprise here in chapter 16 of Mark. Because it's just surprising that there are women who are going to the tomb on that Easter morning. It's not until the end of chapter 15 that Mark even tells us Jesus has women disciples. Where have they been all this time? And here they are at the end of chapter 15. There are these women. They've been silently serving Jesus all through his ministry, and they're still there even at his death. But they're the only ones. First, the religious and the political leaders turn against him. Then his own family abandons him. One of his disciples agrees to betray him. His three closest friends can't stay awake for him. Every disciple runs away in the garden. Peter, the one who said, "I'll never, ever, ever leave you," denies knowing him three times. Finally, cursing the idea that he has anything to do with Jesus. The crowds that had followed him, the ones that had cheered him when he came to Jerusalem, they gather outside Pilate's headquarters and shout, "Crucify him." Representatives of the Gentiles, the most powerful force on earth at that time, the Roman Empire, and the Jewish people, God's own people, condemn him to death. He drags a cross through the streets of Jerusalem, and he's hung above this ugly little killing ground, and he is all alone. But Mark finally tells us there are women there. Women who'd followed him all the way from Galilee. It says that they had served him, and there were many of them. And they're watching, but at a distance. You know, the last person standing by your side when you are in a tight spot is probably going to be a woman. That death row inmate that you see on TV, the person who comes to visit him every week after he's been in there for 30 years, is probably his mother or a wife or maybe a sister. Maybe Mark's been hiding these women all along. No, because he knew that we would get to a part of the story where we're going to need a hero. Except it's going to turn out to be a heroine. The women see the stone rolled away. They go inside. There's a young man sitting there in the tomb. He's dressed in white. The women are alarmed. He says, "Don't be alarmed." He says, "Jesus of Nazareth, the crucified one, is not here. He has risen. Go and tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you to Galilee. You'll see him there, just as he told you." Now, in the Bible, when somebody meets an angel, five things usually happen. First of all, they are terrified. They're afraid. The second thing is an angel tries to console them. It's going to be okay. Then there's this word of revelation. Just like in our story, he's not here, he's risen. Fourth, there's a command to obey. Go, tell his disciples. And so far, so good in our story. All those things line up. Then finally, the recipient of the angel's appearance goes and obeys what the angel says. And it's right here, isn't it, that our story runs right off the track. Because these women who'd followed all the way from Galilee, who've been serving Jesus faithfully and quietly, there's no boasting from them, "I'm never going to fall away." These women who are the last disciples left flee from the tomb, like it's going to cave in on top of them. They run away. They say nothing to anyone. And the last words in the gospel are, "For they were afraid." You know, if you're looking at chapter 16 in your Bibles there, you're saying, "Now hold on, there's some more stuff here." And there's all these footnotes down at the bottom, but I know you don't read footnotes, so just let me tell you what it says. Okay? It says that verse 8, that's the last part of this gospel. The best and the earliest manuscripts of Mark don't have verses 9 through 20. The ancient church leaders, they say that stuff's not original. Okay? It's been tacked on later. And you can see for yourself if you read it later, please, but not during my sermon, that the vocabulary and the style just don't fit Mark. If you've been listening to or reading Mark, it's just not the same stuff. It's obviously stuff that's been cobbled together from the other Gospels and Acts to kind of bring some closure to this book. I mean, what would verses 12 and 13 about? It's just this little snippet that says, "And there were two who met him out in the country one day, and he didn't look like himself," and it goes on. Now, what would that even mean to you if you didn't know the story of Luke, right? And the Emmaus story. So they've taken these other instances and they've tried to put them together to bring an end to this story that just seems right to them. So that means that, you know, you may be disappointed because here in Mark, there's no walking through walls. There's no breakfast on the beach. There's no this triumphant ascension into heaven. The good point is that there's no snake handling, okay? So we can leave that part out. It seems that within 150 years of the writer putting this together, people were so uncomfortable with the negative ending and this lack of triumph that they start to tack on this additional story. They're like those artists who were so offended years later after Michelangelo had painted the Sistine Chapel that they went back and painted clothes on the naked figures. It just doesn't look right. We can't have that in the church. Some folks even today think that the end of Mark's gospel has been lost. You know, maybe it was the end of a scroll and it kind of got torn off there. Or maybe Mark was writing and he had a heart attack right in the middle of a sentence. And there it was, afraid, and it was over. Mark and his followers, they definitely knew the stories of Jesus resurrected. They knew that the women did eventually tell somebody. Their presence, their whole life together was based on that. Our presence here today is based on the fact that those women told somebody. So why does he leave that part out? Why leave it out? We can't know for sure. Well, let's think about this. You know, we have four gospels, four accounts of the life of Christ that God has been so gracious to give us. And think about what a benefit it's been to the world. What a gift to the world. How different the world would be without any one of these gospels, without any one story. But it's also important to remember God in His goodness wants each one of these stories to do the work it was designed to do in us. Each one. Sometimes we're tempted to combine all these gospel stories into kind of one encyclopedia of Jesus in our minds. And that's how we bring it out. And there's benefit, certainly, you know, to combining this knowledge. But the gospels are designed to do something that goes so far beyond knowledge. They're designed to do more than give us knowledge. They're designed to nurture faith in us. Bring us to faith. The last word in this book is about fear. And if you've been reading all along, one chapter a week, as we kind of designed this, isn't that consistent with the rest of the book? Fear. A woman touched Jesus' robe, and she was healed, and she was afraid. She couldn't speak to him. A synagogue leader was afraid. Jesus said, "Don't be afraid." And his daughter was healed. A town's whole town full of people saw the local madman suddenly, because of a moment with Jesus, in his right mind, for the first time in so long, and they're afraid. Evil spirits fall at his feet in fear. The disciples aren't immune to fear. The disciples were afraid when they saw Jesus calm a stormy sea. They were afraid when they saw him walk on water. They were afraid when they saw him transfigured. They were afraid when they saw him continue on his way to Jerusalem, even after he told them what was going to happen there. His fearlessness, even, causes them to be fearful. Mark does not let up on disciples, does he? He doesn't let up on you if you're a disciple. I recently heard Terry Waite. You may remember him. He was a British hostage negotiator. And back in the 80s, he was negotiating for the release of hostages in Beirut, and he was taken by a militant group and held there almost 5 years. Most of it in solitary confinement, most of it chained to a wall. At times he was tortured. On more than one occasion, a mock execution. It's an incredible story that he has. But the thing that he says that he's very proud of is that while they could subject his body and even his mind to all of these things, he did not let up on them. Many different occasions, he would try to form a relationship with a guard because he wanted to ask them, and he asked them this question: "What does the Quran say about stealing?" One day, one of the guards replied to him and said, "The Quran says we should not steal." And then Waite says, "Well, then why have you stolen me from my wife and from my children?" And the guard said, "I think I'm going to have to ask the chief about that." A couple of days later, Waite said he had the same guard again. And he said, "What did the chief say?" And the guard said, "The chief said, I shouldn't talk to you anymore." He didn't let up on these guys. Mark doesn't let up on disciples. He keeps showing us this picture of disciples who are struggling with fear in and out of their relationship with Christ. And he won't let us look away. It seems like he realizes that there's going to come a day when people are going to read this book and they're going to kind of be in the same situation that his original audience is going to be in. They're going to have to believe a story when they haven't seen the whole conclusion of it yet. They're going to have to believe that Jesus was risen when all they're going to get is an empty tomb. That you're going to have to believe what a witness tells you about this. Mark's story is about Jesus, but the surprise is it's also a story about us. We also haven't seen the resurrected Christ, and we can only trust those who did. We also have to deal with fear and weakness as we try to follow Jesus. And if you don't want to be confronted with your own fallibility, if you don't want to be confronted with the ever-present danger of failure, don't read Mark anymore. The question continues to be, will fear shut us up? Will it make us run away? Or will we gather our senses and share with the world what we believe to be true, that Jesus of Nazareth, the crucified one, is risen? As it's been said, if this is true, nothing else matters. And if it is not true, nothing else matters. In a couple of weeks, Allie's going to graduate, our daughter. And so we're going to take her for a little fun trip to Monroeville, Alabama. Bill, you know Monroeville, Alabama, don't you? And that's where Harper Lee is from, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. And so every year at this time, they put on for 3 or 4 weeks the play of To Kill a Mockingbird there at the courthouse. So we're going to take her to the play. And in To Kill a Mockingbird, if you remember high school literature, that main character, Scout, Harper Lee's character, and her brother Jim are being taunted throughout much of the book by their neighbors and their schoolmates because their father, Atticus, has agreed to defend a black man there in their town. Well, there's one elderly neighbor, Miss DuBose, and she sits out on her front porch, and every day when Scout and Jim walk by, she lets them have it. This old lady just insults them and their father as they walk by. So one day, Jim, Scout's brother, has just had enough. So he picks up a stick and he trashes all of her camellias right out there in her front yard. I'll show you, lady. But Atticus won't let the kids get away with it, will they? Will he? And so what he does is he makes the kids go over to Mrs. DuBose's house every afternoon for a month. And they have to read for her out loud for 2 hours every afternoon. So every afternoon, Scout and Jim go over to Miss DuBose's house and they read to her. And she sits there for a while and listens, and then she kind of falls asleep and she's drooling. And then their alarm clock rings, and as soon as 2 hours is up, and they are bolt out the door. Finally, freedom. Well, the month is up. They go on. And a short time after that, Miss DuBose dies. But it's kind of not the end of the story about Miss DuBose. Atticus has this moment with the children later on. And he said, I want you to understand something. Miss DuBose was addicted to morphine. And when you were over there every day and you were reading to her, that helped her wean herself off of that drug. And finally, after your month, you see, she was able to die free, no longer addicted to that. And then Atticus says something to them, and this is really the core of the story. It's really the theme of this book. He says this, kids, I wanted you to see what real courage is. It's when you know you're licked, before you begin, but you begin anyway. And you see it through no matter what. You rarely win, but sometimes you do. Jesus told his followers to pick up a cross if you're going to follow him and carry it. Is it surprising that here at the end of Mark, it's not all sweetness and light? Instead, we get this ending where disciples share this radical cross-carrying life of their Lord. And where it seems like you're licked before you even begin, but you have to begin anyway. And faithfulness is just seeing it through all the way to the end, no matter what. This may not be the happy ending that you're hoping for or that I'm hoping for, you know, here. But maybe it's the ending that we need to hear. We need to know that the power of God can overcome our weaknesses. We need to know that God's promises are going to be fulfilled in spite of our own disobedience. We need to know that if these first followers weren't ultimately defeated, then maybe my fear and my falling and my failure are not going to be final either in my story. I think this is why baptism is just such a perfect picture of the Christian life. It's this picture of going into a tomb, a watery grave, believing that somehow God is going to work life out of this for me. If I can just die to my own empty ideas about myself. Baptism is the way Jesus started his journey, and it's the way Christians have started their journey ever since. If you haven't been baptized and you want to accept Jesus as Lord, we really hope you'll come this morning. This would be a great day to make that proclamation in front of everybody, wouldn't it? To accept a baptism into Jesus, a new beginning in life. Or maybe you'd like the prayers of this congregation. Maybe you'd like to be a part of this congregation. Or maybe you just want to talk to somebody about the kind of story that you read in Mark and about your fear. Well, whichever of those things it is, I invite you to stand now and come forward as we sing.